Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're bringing you today one sweet program.
Yeah, well, sweets for the sweet, something like that.
Right.
But unconventional, not just your sticky toffee pudding or your lemon meringue pie. These are different versions of the art of making things that are sweet.
Yeah, first up, actually, is Marissa McClellan, and she has naturally sweet food in jars, which is a real trend. People are doing everything in jars. So let's listen to Marissa. Marissa McClellan has mastered a niche in the cooking book, well, actually in the preserving book field, which I think is really useful to readers. It started out with food in jars, and then it was preserving by the pint. And the latest book is called Naturally Sweet Food in Jars. Melissa, you've done it again. This is a very, very useful book.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to hear you think so.
Now, you've taken, instead of all the sugar that goes into canning, which always bothered me, too, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, just seeing the volume of it being poured into things. Although it comes out nice and shiny, doesn't it?
It sure does.
But you've replaced it with natural sweeteners.
Yes.
And you have a chapter devoted to each one. And why don't you tell us what the sweeteners are?
Sure. So in this book, instead of using granulated sugar, which is the default in canning, I decided to create recipes that were sweetened with honey, maple, agave, coconut sugar, fruit juice concentrates, and dried fruits, so that there would be recipes available for people of every sort of diet persuasion out there, and allow people to really enjoy their favorite preserves, but do it in a slightly more nutritious and virtuous manner.
Now, how come stevia got left out? You said that.
I'm glad. I hate that stuff.
Deliberately left it out, but why was that?
Well, so the sweeteners I selected were all things that still contained some sugar. So they all either contain fructose, sucrose, or dextrose. And the reason for that is that sugars don't just sweeten, they also provide help with texture and preservation in canning. And stevia, it doesn't contain any sort of true sugar. So all it does is bring sweetness. And when you boil stevia for a long period of time, it turns really bitter. And so I tried some recipes with stevia and just found that they weren't up to snuff, and they didn't hold their quality long on the shelf. And so, my goal wasn't to create a book that was perfect, you know, for people who have to avoid sugar of all stripes, but simply to create more options for people who wanted to reduce their sugar intake and truly bring more flavor to the table.
Oh, I think it's a great explanation. It's helpful for people way beyond the world of canning to understand that cooking with stevia is not like cooking with sugar.
Yeah.
And whether you're preserving it or not, you're going to get the results that you're just pointing out are really not very satisfactory. And you found it out the hard way, I guess.
Yeah, there was some trial and error there before I decided it just wasn't working.
I think you sort of have a preference for honey, by the way.
Yeah, I love honey. Honey is one of my favorite sweeteners, but I didn't want to play favorites too much in this book.
It's the very interesting thing is that you mentioned in the book, and Anne pointed it out to me today as we were getting ready to talk to you, that honey's really amazing because for whatever reason it doesn't spoil.
It's true. It doesn't spoil when it's in its pure state.
Yeah.
But once you dilute honey and then boil it, it doesn't retain that same preservation power.
Sure, sure.
So unfortunately, preserves that are sweetened with honey, they're not going to last as long as sugar-sweetened ones. But they're going to taste better and, you know, feel better for you. So I feel like the trade-offs are worth it.
Oh, I think it's great. I mean, we had a – who was it who sent us that honey that was in a cube?
Oh, a Tonewood.
Tonewood, maybe you know them.
And that's not honey. It's
wasn't it
maple syrup.
It was honey, wasn't it?
No, maple syrup.
It was in like a cube.
It's tonewood. It's maple syrup.
Tonewood. You sure it's maple syrup?
Yeah.
Because it sort of aged peculiarly.
But
I chopped it off and used it. I chopped it off and used it anyway.
Yeah, Savannah bees may have sent us a cube of honey too.
No, I think it was. I think it was tonewood.
Yeah, and that's maple syrup.
I thought it was honey. What do you know? I don't know anything.
Now, Marissa, you take great care in explaining why people should not be terrified of killing their loved ones when they can. But nothing has ever reassured me. I particularly remember the jars of canned tomatoes used to line up the stairs into the basement in the house I grew up in. And there was always one of them bubbling up.
Yeah, well, the reason the tomatoes bubbled over were simply they just weren't processed long enough. Modern instructions for tomatoes have us processing them in a boiling water bath longer than they used to be. But you know, as long as you when we're dealing with sort of safety and canning, the thing that we're all concerned about is botulism, and as long as you have a high acid product, you're never going to have botulism growth because botulism can't develop in high acid environments. So as long as you're working with a recipe that has been developed and designed, you know, with those safety implications in mind, it's really going to be hard to go wrong. And the thing about the tomatoes too is they were fermenting. They weren't dangerous necessarily. They just hadn't been processed long enough to kill off all the bacteria that causes fermentation.
But it's all right to eat them even though they exploded.
No, you wouldn't want to eat them. They wouldn't taste very good, but they're not going to be dangerous.
Let's get really basic here. There are specific reasons why you advocate putting up things in smaller jars and in pints. And particularly now that you're eliminating refined sugars, it becomes important. Why don't you just tell our listeners what the reasons are?
Well, the reason I recommend to preserve in real small jars, particularly with these natural sweeteners, is that, you know, if you're removing sugar, sugar is a powerful preservative. And so once you have reduced or removed refined sugar and you're working with some alternative sweetener, you don't have that same preservative power. And now, they're going to last on the shelf a good while, but once you open those jars and you reintroduce the sort of normal bacteria and yeasts that exist in our air, the preserves will succumb more readily when they're sweetened with alternative sweeteners or sweetened with less sugar than they do when they're sweetened with a lot of sugar. And so by putting preserves in small jars, you set yourself up to be able to eat through them more quickly than you would in a larger jar. And thus, you know, if it does eventually go bad, maybe you only have a tablespoon left in the bottom of the jar as opposed to, you know, a full 8 ounces of product that has gone bad.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really good. You know, if you have a household that can go through a pint of jam in a week, there's nothing wrong with then you preserving these recipes in pints. But if you're the type who takes, you know, a month to go through 4 ounces of jam, when, you know, stick with those 4 ounce jars. Don't go any bigger.
Yeah. No, see, I should have bought a smaller jar of the famous carrot pickle.
Oh, his famous carrot pickle. I mean, I finally talked to him when we got a new refrigerator to dump it. It was probably 20 years old.
It was at least 10.
It was at least 10. And it was still good. He kept eating it.
It was a big jar. I don't know what. I guess it was a good deal at the Indian produce shop. I think it cost like all of about $4.
Well, you talk about no self-respecting organism's going to live in that.
that's what I thought. Anne said it must be spoiled. I said this is not spoiled. This is going to last forever, and she made me throw it out.
Well, vinegar is powerful stuff, but, you know, eventually, I always tell people that when you're preserving food, you're preserving it for a time. You're not preserving it for all time.
Yeah.
And so eventually, it will start to go bad.
I think in this case, I think there might have been a few chilies in there that probably helped, too.
Yeah, that can be.
Yeah. Well, of course, I mean, I feel the same about salt. You know, when I make preserved lemons, you know, I really am so generous on the salt that I don't think any organism would dare attempt to live in it.
probably true.
Now, the thing that I like is not only the practicality of your philosophy of preserving in small jars, but also wherever do you get all these wonderful ideas? Do you create all these recipes? What inspires you?
Well, I do create all the recipes, and I'm really just inspired by the things around me. You know, a wander through a farmer's market can really give me a lot of inspiration, or, you know, a trip to a big Asian grocery store can offer a lot of ideas for me. But to be honest, this is what my brain does, is try to come up with flavor combinations. I kid you not, a couple nights ago, I couldn't sleep for hours because my brain had, the idea of making a salad niçoise had popped into my head, but making it with all pickled items. So I was laying there sort of thinking through all of the different combinations and what I would pickle and what I would leave plain and, you know, and the different kinds of pickles I would make to do that. And it's just how my brain processes, is thinking about flavor combinations and, you know, balancing sweet with acid and spice. And so I can't help but come up with new recipes. I will tell you, this book, a lot of the recipes I brainstormed. I'm someone who really finds a lot of utility in working with someone, and so the initial recipe list for this book was brainstormed while I was driving to Boston for a book event for my last book. Oh. I got on the phone with my mom, and she took notes for me because she was in, you know, sitting at a computer, and I was driving, and we talked through basically this whole book's worth of recipes. And, you know, some changed and shifted as I tried things and they didn't work. But I would say, you know, a good 60% of what ended up in this book was brainstormed while I was driving to Boston.
So your mother is a recipe aficionado as well, huh?
She is, and she's the person I learned to can from. So, you know, she's a great person to bounce ideas with because she understands the mechanics as well. So it really helps.
Well, you have some real strokes of genius in here, and the thing that's amazing is that they're so contemporary. I mean, how long does it take to get a book out? 2 years?
Yeah, about 2 years typically.
You jumped ahead somewhat when you included the gochujang, which I can't pronounce, which is a wonderful, what do we call it, a spice?
Yeah, it's a spice paste. Gochujang is a Korean spice paste. It's salty and spicy and a little bit sweet. And I use it in a barbecue sauce, which, that might sound sort of crazy, but it's an apricot barbecue sauce. And the sweet heat that spice paste brings just lights up those apricots. And it becomes this sauce. I mean, you can use it anywhere you'd use barbecue sauce for, but my favorite thing to do is to use it as a braising medium. So I'll add a little bit more vinegar and then braise like chicken thighs or pork butt in it, and it turns into just this real, like, it's perfect for sort of a barbecue sandwich. It's really good.
Yeah, it sounds terrific, actually. Korean spices aren't as, like, people always talk about kimchi being so spicy and everything, but most of these popular Korean spices aren't all that hot, I've found out.
Yeah, no, it's true. The gochujang is not super spicy. It's just, I think of it as sort of like a little pleasant burn, not anything that's going to, you know, leave you gasping.
Yeah. Now, you're very particular about pickles.
Yes.
Give us some of your philosophy of pickling, pickles.
Well, I am of the school of thought that believes that pickles really need, they're about acid and flavor and texture, you know, and so you need all three of those to make a good pickle. So often when you make pickles out of cucumbers, if you process them in a boiling water bath canner to make them shelf stable, you're going to have the flavor and the acid content, but the heat really softens the cucumbers and makes them soggy. And so I'm of the mind that it's better to make cucumber pickles as refrigerator pickles typically, because that way you're not going to lose the texture and they're going to stay really crunchy. Of course, you're going to have to dedicate a corner of your refrigerator to keeping them, but if you're enough of a pickle fan, it's worthwhile. But there are other vegetables that pickle really beautifully as a preserved pickle and stay crunchy. And those things are like green beans and kohlrabi and fennel. So, you know, I think that you should always try to work with the texture of the vegetable as opposed to against it, and accept that things like cucumbers are going to be a little soft if you process them.
Yeah, I was surprised you have a recipe for pickled shallots.
Yeah. They are delicious.
Yeah, tell us about those.
So the pickled shallots are, you pickle them whole so that they don't lose their texture, but you do process them, I believe. I'm actually running for the book right now to make sure that I'm telling you the truth. But what I love the pickled shallots for is as an addition to salads, or they also make a really terrific topper for like a hamburger or roast chicken. They are just a really nice, basic pickle that's a little different from what you get with a traditional pickled onion.
Uh-huh. And Peter happens to be madly in love with, he's from Yorkshire, north of England. They have these brown pickled onions that we could never find them any place but in Yorkshire.
Oh.
Well, you can find them here, but
the ones
we found had clearly been kept too long because they got soft. They weren't crunchy anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really just, I mean, they're big for onions. They're bigger than cocktail onions, quite
they're
a little
big.
Bit.
Big, yeah.
And the reason they're brown is because they're cured in malt vinegar.
So that makes sense.
So they take the color from the vinegar. But whenever I go to my brother's house, they always make sure there are at least two jars, because they all like them too. And then you can always go just down the road to the village shop and be sure they have some there, whereas you can't find those in village shops in the United States, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's really a bummer that we don't have a more wide variety of pickles. I think you'd like these pickled shallots because they do remain pretty crunchy, because as long as you choose small shallots, you can pickle them whole, and they're really tasty.
There's a great English pickle called Pickle Lily, which is a mustard pickle.
Yeah.
So it's a violent yellow color.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, and my grandmother used to make that all the time.
Yeah, I think it's not unknown in the rest of the world.
I've heard of Pickle Lily, and I find that depending on the region in the U.S. you are, people define it differently. Every region has sort of their own slightly different take on Pickle Lily.
Uh-huh. Okay, could
I've be. Seen it in different sort of different formats throughout my travels as a canner.
Yeah, that's the other thing my grandmother made. I had not experienced it again until I was working on a chef's cookbook a number of years ago. Pickled watermelon rind.
Oh, yeah.
That was a biggie on the farm, yeah. Well, you could read through all these recipes and you'll be amazed, I think. A fennel and parsley relish, pickled cranberries. It seems like there's no end to your inventiveness, Marissa. and you make it all so clear, and you make it sound so simple. I'd like your pickled persimmon slices, actually.
Those are delicious.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you're working on your next book, so I look forward to talking to you about that when it happens.
Absolutely.
Probably be about 2 years from now. Huh?
Probably.
And thank you for talking to us, Marissa.
Thank you so much for having me.
She would be nice if she would do a few extra jars for us, don't you think?
Oh, sure.
we'll have to send her an email and suggest she do that. She's obviously the master of preserving and the master of sweets too, and I wish she lived closer. And we, of course, as close to you as we can be, because we're right here with you on the air, and we hope you'll stay with us while we take a short break, and then we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And so, indeed, we are back. First, we brought you Marissa, and now we're bringing you Anissa. Or you could say Anissa.
They're not exactly sisters.
Not quite. But anyhow, we're moving on to the Middle East, which I'm surprised that more people don't know about Middle East sweets, because they are really intensely sweet.
Used to be always like Turkish delight, and that was about the only thing I knew that came from that part of the world. There are obviously a lot more sweet things than that that come from the bazaars and the kitchens and the restaurants and the whatever throughout the area around the Mediterranean. And Anissa is a real expert on that. Anissa.
Elu is, which means sweet in Arabic, huh?
Is a native of the country, the sadly, unfortunately, now war-torn country of Lebanon and the city of Beirut, but has wisely or otherwise moved to greener pastures in the city of London. Welcome to the program, Anissa.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and you know, your book is Sweet Middle East. And it's classic recipes from baklava to fig ice cream. And I read your introduction and I took issue with the fact, I think everybody knows that Middle Eastern cuisine has absolutely stellar sweets.
Well, if it's true. And if they didn't know that already, they know it after they've read the copy of your book.
Oh, I mean, this photograph of the baklava has been going crazy. I want it so badly, you know. So, now, you are not a baker.
I am not a baker, no.
No, nor am I.
But I did write a book about savory baking in the Mediterranean.
Right.
I mean, I'm not a professional baker, but I know how to bake.
Right. No, but you must have been asked a lot about sweets and desserts in the Middle East, which is why you wrote the book, right?
Exactly.
Uh-huh. But how many books have you written, Anissa?
I think 8 now.
Really? And that doesn't count all the other kinds of writing you do for magazines.
No, I mean, I've done journalists, my blog. I mean, recently I haven't blogged that much, but no, I've written, you know, quite a lot apart from the books, yes.
Well, I really thought I understood most of the things about the basic ingredients in Middle Eastern cuisine, but you threw me with some of these that I never heard of at all. Some really unusual ingredients. In fact, like sago.
Like
sago.
What?
Sago.
Sago, right?
Sago.
Sago. Isn't that the one we used to call frog spawn?
I don't know. It's it's kind of starch from the palm tree.
But it comes in little balls, right?
Yes, it does.
You know, when my mother used to make it, we used to call it frog spawn.
Looks like tapioca.
Looks a little bit, yes, looks like tapioca, doesn't taste like it.
Exactly, but it's not. I mean, they're different things, but it is similar, yes.
It's similar in appearance, but it comes directly from a plant.
Yes.
Now, your intention in writing this book is that people like me could actually make these at home, right?
Exactly. Because usually in the Middle East, people don't make their sweets at home.
No.
Not, I mean, some sweets they make at home, and most of the sweets are bought from the sweet makers, professional sweet makers. Right. In Morocco, they have specialist women who come and make, you know, like the Comme de Gazelle, you know, the kind of almond pastries and things like that. So the sweets are kind of the preserve of professionals much more than home, you know, home cooks.
And men, you said. You said men primarily, huh?
And primarily men, although in Morocco, for instance, it would be women for some things. But in the Levant, it would all be men. I mean, if you go into the kitchens of sweet makers, you wouldn't see women.
Now, hold on for just a second, because you used the term just now to deal with the geography. And I sort of thought I understood it, but perhaps I don't entirely understand it. Can you explain the difference between the Levant and the Middle East?
Well, the Levant is basically Turkey, Lebanon, Syria. Actually, it can include Greece as well. In my book, which was called Levant, I have included also Iran, although that was kind of stretched.
Okay.
But it's, you know, it's the kind of... It means where the sun rises.
Yes.
Le soleil levant in French. And it's that eastern part of the Mediterranean.
Okay, but the Middle East, which is further east, and North Africa, which is obviously in a different place altogether, these are, in fact, covered in your book.
Yes, yes.
Well, the recipes are so appealing. I never knew... There were so many variations on halva.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of intriguing because most people think halva is the tahini halva, and they don't know.
Right.
I mean, most people in the West, they don't know about the flour halva and the semolina halva and other kinds of halvas. So, yes, I mean, it could be a whole section of a book about halvas.
They also don't know about desserts that have chicken in them.
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
that was pretty sneaky.
Chicken.
That's true. And you don't taste the chicken, but you do feel it. You do feel the texture a little bit.
I mean, even Colonel Sanders, who founded the Kentucky Fried Chicken Company, never put chicken in his desserts. Now, some people would say he never...
True.
Some people would say he never put chicken in any of his other dishes either, I guess.
And he said, I understand, of course, that saffron is the most expensive spice in the world, and I understand why, because there are so few of those little things in each flower, and it's all handwork. But I never knew about cardamom being the second most expensive, and why?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
That's a good question. I'm not sure why. But it is.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I don't know.
Huh. So anyhow, but you go through just all this background information that people are going to need to understand the whole attitude of the Middle East towards desserts, including the wonderful spices available. And you have a section on nuts. And preparing nuts. I found the reference to it, but I couldn't find the recipe for a dessert eggplant. Where is that?
A dessert eggplant. Well, I don't have it in the book, but in Syria they candy baby eggplants. And it's actually quite wonderful. They have this tradition of candying fruit, all kinds of fruit, from prickly pears to tangerines to, well, clementines to pears to green walnuts, actually, and these tiny baby eggplants, tiny, which they core and then they candy, and they're crunchy and absolutely delicious, and of course you don't taste. I mean, it doesn't have a savory taste at all.
Uh-huh. Well, now, your explanation of why you and many, many people in this geographical era have a penchant for sweets. And you say mm-hmm. it's because of the Muslim prohibition of alcohol that the sweetness comes from sugar and desserts?
Yeah, I mean, it's a conjecture more than an absolute theory. Uh-huh. But a lot of people in that part of the world don't drink wine.
Right.
And I'm assuming that this kind of, you know, craving for sweet, I mean, which you get. If you drink wine, you get a little bit of sugar, comes from sweets. But it's also because of the hospitality. There is, I mean, Arab or Middle Eastern hospitality is legendary. And you always offer, I mean, you offer coffee or tea, depending on which country you're in. And with that, with the beverages, you offer something to eat. And because it's in between meals, often it's sweets.
Right. You say that after a meal, you get fruit, but in between meals, you get sweets.
Yes. On the whole, yes.
Except
when you have big parties.
Oh, okay. But, I mean, that's very reasonable. I think it's sort of, it's a better approach than throwing dessert on top of a heavy meal.
Absolutely, and it's kind of healthier in a way, except that, you know, those who have a really sweet tooth and tend to overdo the sweets, then they kind of undo all the goodness of not eating them after the meal.
Explain mastic. What does mastic do, and does it have flavor?
It definitely has flavor. It's a kind of, it's a very intriguing flavor that can also be very bitter if you overuse it. I mean, if you have too much mastic in the whatever sweet it is, or even savory, because they use it in savory dishes as well. It's a resin that has a kind of, I don't know how to describe the flavor apart from it being exotic. And like, for instance, if you're making muhallabiyya, which is the milk pudding, and sometimes I forget to put mastic, then the milk pudding is quite boring. And the mastic kind of elevates the sweets because of that kind of intriguing, rather mysterious flavor. And you need to use very, very little, actually.
Uh-huh.
And some people say that the mastic, because it's actually chewing gum, adds texture, like in the salep ice cream, you have mastic.
Right.
But in fact, the texture comes from the salep and not from the mastic. The mastic is used basically for the flavor, and in such tiny quantities that really it cannot really affect the texture.
Huh. Now, nuts are common, and they're probably the best nuts in the world that you can find there, huh?
Well, for sure, pistachios.
Pistachios,
you know,
my favorite nut.
Yeah, I mean, you do have fantastic pistachios in Sicily as well, but the best pistachios in the world are from Iran or from Syria or from Turkey.
And
the Greeks have pistachios as well.
Yeah, and then there's the issue of pine nuts. That I can't believe the route that pine nuts have taken. They're so expensive. I sent Peter off to get some pine nuts for making pesto, and I said, don't buy the Chinese ones. I don't like buying anything from China in the food line. And so I didn't notice until I was actually making the pesto. There was this one little container of pine nuts from, I can't remember, I think they were from Portugal, and they were $48.
Yeah, they're very expensive now, but I never use Chinese. But most people use Chinese pine nuts now. And every time I look at a cookbook and at photographs and see these tiny, stubbly nuts, and I think, oh, no, they shouldn't.
No.
In Italy, they don't use them at all. They use the Mediterranean pine nuts, and they are so much better.
So Venezuelan's the way to go, huh?
Yeah.
And the other thing I found was interesting is a lot of twists on what we consider Western desserts, which get a different twist, such as aniseed biscotti. You have Turkish macaroons. I didn't know they existed. And I was surprised about all the shortbread that you have.
Yes, well, they're very common in Lebanon, in Turkey, and in Syria, but they're different from the shortbread here, for instance. Like in England, the shortbread is kind of not dense, but it's very crumbly, but it doesn't melt in the mouth, whereas our shortbread really melts in the mouth, and it's kind of softer. It's still crunchy, but it's softer, and it kind of disappears quicker.
Well, I mean, we're down to the basics here now, the nitty gritty, and that's all the desserts made with phyllo.
Yeah. In the old days, they used to make the phyllo, but now you buy it.
Yeah, well, I mean, how often have you worked with phyllo?
I loved your description of the little men in white uniforms.
It's true.
Making phyllo in giant sheets and thinking it's no trick at all.
But of course I didn't know that the term baklava is generic, but that's one of my notes. I don't have a sweet tooth, to be perfectly honest. But if I do want some, I want it to be really intense. And that's why I love these Middle Eastern desserts. Because they are
intense. Yeah, they're definitely intense.
So, well, again, this is Sweet Middle East, and maybe if you are on your New Year's diet, you should buy the book and just look at the pictures rather than make these. But, and Anisa and Lou, thank you for visiting with us.
Thank you for having me on the program.
Okay, I'll tweet you soon.
Okay.
Thanks, Anisa.
Thanks, Anne.
Ciao. Ciao.
Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We seem to get a lot of who knew moments on the menu, and here's a new one. New being spelled differently. New K-N-E-W, new N-E-W. But anyhow, I never heard of Manuka honey before, but here we have it, and we have David Knoll.
You were saying Manuka. I didn't know where you were going there.
Why? What is it?
Well, you said hookah or nuka. I couldn't quite understand what you were rhyming with exactly.
Oh, well, we're going to have Manuka.
Manuka, okay.
Honey.
And Manuka is a plant.
It's a bush, I think.
A bush, yeah. Well, it's a plant. A plant's a bush, right? Like a tree. And apparently it makes real good honey. And who knew that you could bring honey all the way from New Zealand and people would absolutely love it, but apparently they do. And here's David.
Knoll. Remember his
son
Chuck.
Son of the other Chuck Knoll. Giggle, 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 those of us from Pittsburgh, City of Champions. Here's David. Welcome to Pittsburgh, David Knoll, son of the other Chuck Knoll. and David said his father indeed is familiar with the Pittsburgh connection, but there is none.
Yeah, but nothing there, just the name.
The start of this story is kind of long and complicated, but I can net it out a little bit by saying that in the early 1970s, living in California, David's family decided to run away.
Amen.
Because they had this feeling that California might slip off somewhere in the Pacific Ocean. And how much further away could they get than New Zealand? So off you went, right?
Yes, true. Absolutely true.
Packed your bags and off to New Zealand and discovered that it was really a rather heavenly place.
That's correct, with lots of beaches.
which apparently was important to you at the time. I guess there were beaches in California too.
But he was a surfer.
Yeah, all we had was surfboards and guitars in those days.
Yeah, I had asked Peter about my albatross, car that I traveled with.
So what happened then? then you changed your mind and decided to come back to California, but in the meantime you discovered something very interesting about this wild and wonderful country down under called New Zealand.
Yeah, we just, I lived there for 13 years, and I had no intentions of leaving and coming back to stay. Like a lot of things in your life, things happen by mistake, and they always seem to turn out to be good. But we were just coming over for a visit, my wife and I, with three of our six children at that time, to show my mom and dad that we're living in California. And we never planned to stay here, and a couple of buddies that were doing some beekeeping and other little projects were having difficulty breaking into the U.S. market, so they stuffed some samples in my bag, and I landed in Santa Barbara, California, and started to show them around, and it was probably the wrong place to do that because Santa Barbara loves honey. People in Santa Barbara just love all kinds of different types of honey, and so we had a really good reaction. And, we didn't have any intention of staying. I said, well, it's time for you guys to send somebody over and, pick up the pieces. But what we found over the period of time was because of my, being from California, I was a good interface to bring the two cultures together. They had been trying to introduce product for some time and just weren't getting anywhere. But coming from living in New Zealand for 13 years and having been born and raised in California, I had a really good idea of what the two cultures were all about and how to best bring them together. So that was, how it started. And we rented our house out for 3 months and then for 6 months and then a year. And then, as time went on, it just kept going and we got bigger and started bringing in more product. And here we are today, 30 years later, with grandkids and still waving the flag for New Zealand.
And your company is called Pacific Resources International. And what exactly does that company do?
We're just strictly importers, and we strictly import exclusive New Zealand items. New Zealand is our only trumpet to blow. We love New Zealand. We want to make sure that their products get exposed to the U.S. consumer in the best possible way. Because all the things that I experienced, including finding my beautiful wife in New Zealand, I wanted to share with where I came from, with the people. I didn't expect to find what I found in New Zealand, and a lot of people were unaware of the quality and the type of things that New Zealand could produce. And I just wanted to share that with everybody here, first in California, and then, as time has gone on, with the nation.
Now, well, you're doing this full time now, but you weren't doing that at the time, though.
No, I would work with my dad just doing handyman work around the place, painting kitchens and doing small remodel jobs and bathrooms and stuff. And that was, part of the week. And the rest of the week, we would go out and see a couple of health food stores and talk to them about New Zealand products. And, they were always excited to see the high quality that New Zealand produced. And we really didn't have a whole lot of no's. People would pick them up right away and put them on the shelf. And the consumer always saw the quality there. And so if I could get the products on a shelf, they pretty much sold themselves. There wasn't a whole lot of selling going on. If people tried the quality of the honey or the sea salt or some of the bee products, they could tell right away how much better they were coming from New Zealand than other parts of the world.
Now, why is the bee culture so big in New Zealand?
I think it's partly because there's not a lot to do. and when I arrived there in 1974, they had one TV station, and it went off air at about 9 o'clock at night.
Oh dear!
And so there wasn't a lot, and so it was always been a hobby for a lot of New Zealand people. And then what they call pocket money, a lot of people would be doing it on the side, weekends and during the week to earn a little bit extra money for themselves. And the New Zealand people are very artisan. They make a lot of lovely products, and they pride themselves on doing a good job, and a lot of them just do beekeeping. Of course, there's the pollination side of it. A lot of people are farmers there, and they need the pollination, so they kept the bees, to help pollinate their crops and also produce the honey. But the bottom line is that New Zealand is a haven for bees. It is just
well, I'm glad
absolute,
some places, you know,
yeah,
poor
it's,
bees.
The bees around the world are pretty much the same. They're the same breed, the same type. There's not a whole lot of difference in them. It's the environment that they can live in that make them thrive and produce a high quality honey. Your high quality honeys come from places like Hawaii, some places around the Amazon in the rainforest, some places of Africa. New Zealand has a unique set of its own plants and flowers, and it's a pristine condition. There's just very little pollution or things to stop the bees from collecting high quality honey. Not only honey, but they have the highest rated royal jelly, the highest rated bee pollen, the highest rated bee propolis in the world.
What's propolis?
Propolis is a natural antibiotic that the bees create. Some people call it bee spit.
I don't know about that.
It's a brown, tarry substance, and it's very, very antibacterial. They coat the hive with it. They say that the beehive is the cleanest place on the face of the earth on the inside, and it just keeps everything antiseptically clean on the inside of the beehive.
Now, do the bees dance to tell each other where they're going to go next?
Oh, yeah. They do.
Yeah, we found out quite a lot about bees from a lady who manages hives for people who want to have them in the London area. She has a number of hotels and other kinds of places that are her clients. And we interviewed her for our program. Wasn't her name Capital Bees, I think, was the name of the company?
I think so.
She told us a lot we didn't know.
There's a book about the bee dances. I mean, they all mean things, these bee dances.
Oh, yeah. It's sort of a Morse code, if you like. They send out little vibrations.
Uh-huh.
And that translates into a language, you know. It's quite an interesting society to watch and to learn and to understand.
Yeah, I love that whole thing. What is now Manuka? Is a bush or a tree?
It's kind of halfway between. It's what they call a native bush. It usually grows anywhere from 4 to 6 foot. Can go 10 feet high, but it's what they call a scrub brush. Its original name Manuka means life giving because it's the first tree to come in after a disaster. To repopulate the area from a fire or storms. It usually provides the cover for a lot of the native trees to then seed and grow up over the top of the Manuka. But it grows wild around the coastal areas. It takes a lot of abuse. It likes salty, tough conditions. And it has a really tiny little flower. It's not much bigger than the eraser on a pencil that either come out in a kind of a pinkish or a white pink a color, and it's very prolific. In the early days, it was a nuisance. They would clear it right off the land to make room for grazing for sheep or for dairy farms or for agriculture. They didn't see much use in it, and that whole thing has turned around now. There's so much money involved with Manuka honey that some of the dairy farmers are now planting Manuka back on their property.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, getting rid of their cows. And just collecting honey.
So honey became a big business.
It does.
The
Manuka honey business is, if not a billion, it's a multi-million-dollar industry now, because of one reason only, and that's because it works. I'm astounded by the prices that people pay for a pound of honey, and I thought, you know, even 10 years ago, that the price would soon, you know, kill off its good venture, but it works and it works and it works, and people
well,
are.
What
really
does it do?
There's two things that it's been noted to do. It was originally discovered by Dr. Peter Mullen out of the Waikato University on the South Island of New Zealand. I'll take that back. I think he's on the North Island. He has since passed away just recently, but he discovered it by experimenting with honeys. He was looking for something to deal with intestinal bacteria because that was his specialty. And he had a number of patients that were suffering from H. pylori and different intestinal bacteria problems. And he found that at room temperature in the lab that any raw honey would kill off all these intestinal bacteria without any problem whatsoever. he got elated. He thought he found the wonder drug of the 21st century and started giving it to all his patients. They all took it, and in a lot of cases, some got worse, and none of them got better.
Yeah, well, I mean, you'd have to be pretty. I mean, is this honey? I mean, do they have selective properties about which bacteria they eliminate? Because you need a lot of that bacteria.
He was primarily dealing with the not so good ones, what we call unfriendly bacteria in the stomach, and so he was scratching his head. He couldn't figure out what happened for the life of him. Finally, after about 18 months, almost 2 years, he found that it was the body temperature at 98.6 degrees that was the problem. Most of the beehives out there range in a temperature of 68 to 72 degrees. So most of the honeys didn't have to remain active outside of those temperatures. They could retain their antibacterial properties within that temperature without any problem.
Does it taste any specifically different from regular honeys?
Oh, yeah. It's like any of the darker honeys, like an avocado or buckwheat or any of those darker type honeys. It has a stronger, more molasses type flavor. It's not as sweet as your lighter honey.
Yeah, I wonder why the bees that are suffering from colony collapse disorder, why they can't get something like that to sterilize their beehives.
No, they could. There's a lot of things that go into colony collapse. One is that a lot of beekeepers restrict their bees on a singular diet. They don't give them the variety that they need. You can imagine if you could only eat hamburgers day in and day out, year after year after year. And a lot of beekeepers have done that with pollination, with feeding them sugar. And when they get diseases, they spray them with antibiotics and pesticides to try to remove the problem. And so there's a lot of factors that have contributed to the colony collapses. It's been mostly poor beekeeping. That's been the problem. It also has some environmental things where the bees just can't have a clean environment. You know, they're too close to cities. Just as an example, the bees have to make the propolis, and so they make it out of normal tree sap or resins from trees. They'll actually chew up this stuff. The next closest thing to that, if they can't get a tree sap, is the tar off a road.
Oh, no.
Or oil from a parking lot.
Oh, dear. They will be thinking bees are smart, and it turns out they're not that smart after all.
If you could buy this, like as if you were just buying a specialty food product, not necessarily through a health food store.
It's more and more the Manuka honey is getting into what we call mass market stores or crossover stores. There's more and more Manuka honey showing up in places. I don't know if you're familiar with King's Market on the East Coast or Giant. Some of those what we call mass market stores are moving into that area. It's not so much that they're chasing after just Manuka honey, but over the last 15 years, natural food products have been the biggest growth area in the grocery business.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, so you see more and more general grocery stores now carrying, a smattering, if not a good selection, of healthcare products.
And what Peter was leading into was the other product that you're proud of is the really pure sea salt. Everybody's into sea salt, but explain. I mean, I've talked to food scientists who say that all salt is sodium chloride, period. And that's not true.
It's sort of like saying all sugar is sugar, and that's a true fact. It's the form of the sugar that's important. And if you refine sugar or sodium chloride, you're going to get the bad parts of it instead of all the good. The whole molecule is what I like to refer to it as. Our salt is done like everybody used to do salt. It's the cheapest way to do it. The only problem today is that the oceans are dirty. 80% of our oceans are unclean for salt production. They cannot dry it naturally in the sun and the wind for 13 months like we do and have been doing since day one, since probably the late 1700s, early 1800s. where they found a bay that was below sea level that they could siphon water into and just let it sit and produce salt with the sun and the wind. Very much like they did sugar in the early days in Hawaii. They had no refining tools, so they would just put the organic or just the natural cane juice out in the open and let the sun and the wind dry it until it formed a nice dark brown crystal of sugar, which was whole and complete and very healthy for you. It was only with the advent of drying machines that they started stripping all the natural trace elements off the sugar and the salt. But in the case of the salt, they had to do it because the ocean water was dirty. And a lot of the, you know, ground mined salts have runoff, you know, over years of pollution that floats down out of the sky and just heavy metals that are naturally found in the soil. They go into these ground salts and they produce very high amounts of trace elements, which most people just don't need. The only difference with New Zealand and the rest of the world is that we still have clean waters.
Yes.
And so we're still able to naturally dry the salt without taking out the impurities and all the trace elements. So you have a natural product that has all the natural calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, just about every known element to man is in a natural sea-occurring sea salt. This salt is so perfectly balanced, it's the same salinity and same pH as you find in your tears, in your blood, and it's also in the amniotic fluid that you live in for the first 9 months of your life.
So you've got the world covered, pretty much. You've got something sweet, you've got something salty. What next?
It's kind of a salty snack that we brought in is the new proper crisps from New Zealand. New Zealand still has different potatoes than everybody else in the world, and so they make kind of a unique potato chip, which we just started bringing in. We're also looking at a gentleman called Pick, who's just started making peanut butter in New Zealand, and we're going to try to help develop his line for the U.S. market. He has an interesting story. He was a postman and lost his job and decided he couldn't sit around doing nothing, so he started making peanut butter in his garage and then was selling it down at the farmer's market in New Zealand for a while, and now he's starting to ship it everywhere around the world.
I tell you, that the chips, the cider vinegar and salt potato chips,
oh, yes.
They are really splendid.
We
ate them at a single sitting.
Yeah.
And the little chocolates aren't too bad either.
Yeah, that's we would try to find easier ways for people to get the Manuka honey in their system.
Got it.
Because it is good for them, and not everybody wants to carry around a pot of honey.
well, we have a pot of yogurt and pour some honey on it and consume that. And
yeah.
I'm relieved to know that it's not only does it taste good, it's also doing me good.
Yeah, well, the best way to get all the benefits of Manuka honey is to take it on an empty stomach, but you can mix it with yogurt and other things. It loses some of its activity like most honey does when you overheat it. So if you mix it with coffee or tea, you're best to let it cool down a little bit before you put it in your tea or your coffee so that it's not too hot when that honey first goes in, because you can lose some of the attributes of any honey when you mix it with a really hot drink.
Oh, I wasn't thinking about doing that for 1 minute. Sweetheart, you're looking at me. Anne's looking at me strangely.
Yeah, well, people always want to find an easy way. So we make throat lozenges for dry and tired throats. We have the candies and the Manuka nuggets. We now have honey sticks for children. We have lollipops for children that they can use. That we have cough elixirs and throat sprays and all kinds of stuff that you can get a good dose of Manuka honey to help keep your well-being up to scratch.
David, do you have a website with a store locator?
I don't. We don't have a lot of, because we're importers, we don't list a lot of the retail stores.
Oh, I see. Okay, yes. Yes,
yeah,
yes.
The distributors, we sell to distributors and a lot of them. We're just starting to put that together now because we do have quite a few independent stores that buy from us. And I think in the next 6 months you'll see our website updated in some of those stores.
Okay.
But because we've been importers for so long, we haven't made that that opening to our customers. But our website is shop, S-H-O-P-P-R-I. That's two P's in the middle. It's shop, S-H-O-P-P-R-I.com. And you can go there and see all the chips, the salts. We have a great new barbecue salt. We have a great new Manuka salted caramel we just came out with. It was a big hit at the last two shows that that we did.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure. It's been a remarkable life story you've had, and it's certainly far from over yet. So I'll be surprised if our paths don't cross again sometime in the future when you've come up with something else miraculous to add to your portfolio of products. And in the meantime, we wish you well and all your family and all your grandchildren and all your children.
Well, I appreciate it, and thank you for taking the time to talk to me today.
I guess you got the story. There's some salt in there, too. But let's not that come between us, because we're the sweetest of the sweet. We know you are, too. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week. And until the meantime, until then.
Bye-bye.